My name's Michelle Karpinko. I'm glad you're all here this evening. I hope your friends and fellow workers who couldn't make it tonight, you could pass on a few words to them, spare them some discomfort and pain. As was announced, my topic tonight is, oh, my aching back. And I think we could subtitle that, Prevention and Care. Most of us don't realize that approximately 4 out of 5 people could admit to at least one significant episode of back pain at some time during their life. That's most of us. And I'm in the 4 out of 5. So I'll join many of you. In the United States alone, backache has produced more than 19 million doctor visits, and it adds 8 million new victims each year to an already existing 75 million sufferers. Few afflictions are as prevalent, as excruciatingly painful, and as diagnostically elusive. It's had profound implications, not just to people individually, but to companies and employers. It just boils down to dollars and cents. The man hours that have been lost due to back injury is staggering. I am often working in a physical therapy department in a hospital, and in that setting, many days, 3/4 of my patient load are people who are suffering from back pain for one reason or the other. Now, I'm here obviously not as a diagnostician or as a physician or as an orthopedic or neurosurgeon, but I would like to share from my professional field of physical therapy maybe 3 basic areas. The first one is I'd like to give you some basic understandings of the problems and how they're traditionally treated. The second area is some hints on preventative care. And the third area is some self-helps when you get in trouble. Okay? Now, the problem has many sources, and I really tried to jot that down for you up here on newsprint so that it'd stick a little longer in your brain. The first one is stress. And I'm sure that's something that we all work with in varying forms in our lives. And stress has a habit of finding the weakest point in your body and aggravating it. For some people, they get ulcerative colitis, or just colitis when they get uptight or overloaded. Other people, it's their neck. Many people, it's their back. You may start to think, well, sometimes my backache produces stress. And in a certain extent, that's true. If you know anything about the pain spiral, we know that whether it's stress, fear, or worry, for example, when you drive through a snowstorm for 3 or 4 hours, what does your neck and the back of your head feel like? I can hardly turn mine. Okay, it has produced localized tension. And that tension, after a while, your muscles stay tight just so long, and you're not getting waste products out of the muscle tissue, you're not getting fresh oxygenated blood in, and you get pain. Now, the spiral will continue. That person with the back pain, it has started, whether it's been a psychological stress or a physical stressor. Once they've got that pain, they start thinking about, golly, I've got to stay in bed for 2 weeks. That means I don't get to go to work. I'm not going to get paid for those 2 weeks. I've got a big dental bill coming up. My car insurance is due, and the list goes on and on and on. And what happens? Their back gets tighter. And they don't recover very fast. Okay, so the stress works 2 ways. The second area up here, muscle strain, is probably something that is that everybody experiences in varying degrees. It's the most common source. And this is oftentimes that weekend warrior, the weekend athlete, who goes out and doesn't do his or her homework during the week in terms of staying in shape. But boy, they go out and they play two ball games back to back, and who knows what else. Or maybe it's the springtime gardener. Boy, the first good sunny day and you get out in that garden and you just go to town, don't you? I do. I usually pay for it by nighttime. Or it's that early snowfall and you get out there with your shovel, you know, before you find a neighbor who has a Toro, and you get with it on the snow. Or many times this is a problem that's connected with prenatal pregnancy times, where the just physiologically there's a lot of strain on a woman's back. We can also do it from lifting improperly, twisting and turning improperly, or working out away from our body. And that's why doing dishes by hand is so uncomfortable, because we got to go over the sink and work out here for a period of time when we're static. And it's that working out away from your body that puts your back in an overextended position, which is really tough. I noted that when I was washing pots and pans here. I am tall, and the sink was not built for tall people. The next one down the line is muscle spasm, and I have differentiated it on purpose.
I've got that.
I hope not. Because usually you can get over a muscle strain in about a week, but muscle spasms, your muscle has really become knotted, and it may take you several weeks to really work through that. And it's probably just a severe case of strain where your muscles do not have a chance to get stretched out and relax from that strain and instead knot up. The fourth one that's on our list is a herniated disc. How many of you have heard of a herniated disc? Okay. How many of you have experienced a herniated disc? Okay, the odds dropped a little bit. But our spine is made up of vertebra. And they don't sit smack on top of each other. There's a little cushion pad in between, right in here. And that's a disc. And that disc is made up of, on its outer borders, if you were to look at it cut across section, has fibrous tissue, makes a tough fiber band around the outside, and it has kind of a pulpy center. Sometimes due to trauma, usually, that band will give, has a weak spot. And you'll get some of the pulp that will protrude out to one side. When it does that, it usually puts pressure on a nerve. Okay, your spinal cord is coming down through here, and nerves are branching out in between these little bony processes. Now, you don't have to imagine too hard before you realize that if it's going to bulge here, it's going to pinch on a nerve very quickly. Degenerated disc is a little bit different, and this is often a complication of the aging process, and it's basically this disc disintegrates so that you in fact have a narrow disc space and you have a vertebra rubbing against a vertebra with no pad in between. Now, the sixth one I've got up here is sciatica, and that's a word that I think has become more and more common. What it's describing is pain from one particular nerve. It's probably the largest nerve that branches off our spinal cord, and it branches off right around your lumbar vertebra, somewhere between L4 and L5, and this is probably the area of most weight and pressure in your entire spine. It's down in that curve in your low back, right about in here. And as that nerve branches off, because this is such a common site for discs to get injured and to bulge, this nerve is often affected. It's the nerve that goes down through the cheek of your buttock. There's a little hollow in here, and it goes right through there, goes down all the way to your toes. It goes down the back of your leg, to your heel, and to your toes. Many times, the reason it is bothering you is can be disc related, or it can be muscle spasm related. Okay, that you don't have a disc problem, but that you've got muscles that are spasmed in this low back area or in through here that are giving it a killer hold. Okay, you can have numbness, tingling, sharp shooting pain. You can have a variety of symptoms. So we could really say that the sciatica could be a combination of actually the muscle spasm or from a disc or even from sometimes a degenerative situation. Okay, when we go down to the next number, we're talking about osteoarthritis. Most of us think, well, that's what people who are in their 70s and 80s and 90s have. I already have some. I don't think I'm there yet. It's, again, changes in the vertebrae themselves. The little cartilage edge on those vertebra has first softened, then roughened, and then lost its outer little cartilage layer. Then you have a hard bone surface rubbing on a bone surface. And oftentimes with it, you get some disc degeneration. And it's a very common problem, very tough to work with. Congenital abnormalities is an umbrella term that takes in all kinds of things. My husband and I could both fall into that category. Now, we look pretty normal, I hope. But I have an extra vertebra in my back, which means I have an even longer lever arm to work with. And he had a lower vertebra that had what we call a, here's the bumpy part you feel on your spine, and there's a wing on each side. And when you get down by your sacrum, that's the arrowhead part of your spine. These fuse and attach to the side of your pelvis. Well, on one side his was attached, the other side it was freewheeling. So he was getting some torquing in there in his back. There are lots of other abnormalities. We can talk about spina bifida, where there's been an incomplete closure of the back. And that's something that occurred during fetal growth. And it may be so subtle, or there may be so little of it that it's never caught unless you're x-rayed. Those are just a few examples. The next one on our list is leg length discrepancy, and that slides by most of us. But what happens is just after years and years of growing and being an adult, been walking around with a half an inch or more leg length discrepancy, you've been walking around in life with one pelvis higher than the other, and it does affect your back. And you don't have problems right away, you have problems way down the road. Okay, the next one, scoliosis. That's something we hear about for teenagers, because that's when it's usually first spotted, somewhere between 12 and 15 up to 17 and 18, and it's an S curve in your back, sideways. We have a curve the other way. We have a curve, it dips in our neck, out a little bit over our chest, and in a little bit again over the lower part of our back. But I'm talking about laterally, instead of the spine being nice and straight. When you lean over, somebody were to watch the bumps in your back, and when you came back up, those bumps should be nice and straight in a row. But you see some, this is pretty drastic, you see some curving on one side, and of course if it curves to one side, it's got to have a compensatory curve on the other side to balance itself out. This can cause some minor problems, or if it's a severe case, it can cause some real severe problems, even internally. Fracture I included because it's something that I see, especially in the older age group, because bones have thinned and become more brittle. I think the most common thing I see are compression fractures. The where they have fallen, and there are fracture lines across the vertebral body itself. Sometimes we hear about fractured back with a younger person. Again, it's usually been a traumatic injury, a bad fall. Okay, the next and the last one, posture, and I hooked it to body build intentionally. I think there are two types of body builds that are more prone to problems. One of them is the person who is overweight because they're adding a lot of body weight that their back has to support. Second person is someone who's built somewhat like myself, who has an overly long back. And again, with stooping and lifting, we're talking about a longer lever arm that's working from basically one point in your spine. And if you don't know how to use your back properly, you can abuse it very quickly. In terms of posture, I'd like to mention the two common things I see. One is the person who's sway back. Okay? They've got that back porch way out there. And the other person is the one who has a more pronounced hump through their back, the upper back. We call that kyphosis. The other sway back condition we call lordosis. With the kyphosis, where you get, this often occurs with arthritis, by the way, you get a raise, a bigger hump in your chest area, you have to have a compensatory increased curve in your cervical, your neck area as well. You try that, hump your back up. Now, I want you to try to keep your chin tucked in and your head straight and keep your hump in your upper back. Now, I want you to let your neck go and let your chin jet forward. Does it feel more balanced than if you got it tucked in? You kind of lost the curve in your back, I think, if you brought your chin in. Okay. Now, very quickly, I'm just going to touch on some of the traditional things that are used in the 12 things we've talked about so far. There is a great degree of variance and success. A lot of it depends on the person's attitude, how they feel about what's being used. If they believe in it, that's probably 75% of the battle. For spasms and strains, most often you go to your physician and he may give you a muscle relaxant or tranquilizer, something to kind of sedate you a little bit better so that you stay down and rest more. He may suggest, well, you could try a heating pad, and if you like Band-Aid, you can put that on. That's a good old favorite. And if it just doesn't go away after a while, he says, well, maybe you should try some physical therapy. Now, what do physical therapists do in that kind of situation? They usually have a fairly standard approach. One is to use some form of moist heat, which is usually some type of hot pack, to use ultrasound, which is a machine that uses sound waves to create heat deeper down in your tissue than the hot packs will do. That allows the circulation to increase to help get those arteries and veins open again so that you can get some good circulation going to those muscles and they'll relax better. Then they usually do massage and everybody goes, ah, that's the best part. Sometimes they'll have to add traction. Sometimes they will give you special exercises to also help your back relax. Other times they'll even use some forms of electrical current to manually exercise the muscles to get them to unwind and to relax for you if you're not doing a very good job of doing that yourself. When we get into situations where there's a little bit of dislocation along with the muscle spasm or muscle strain, sometimes spinal manipulation is also used and can be helpful. When we get into the area of herniated discs and occasionally degenerative discs, we're talking about, first of all, rest and the heat and all the other things I've already mentioned. And when that doesn't work, after usually they give you about a month or two, then they'll say, well, maybe better get a surgeon's opinion. If something is done surgically, it's usually in the form of repairing this disc. That's called usually a laminectomy, and the term simply describes where they enter the vertebra, the lamina of the vertebra is where they enter, so they call it a laminectomy. That's why it's got such a funny name. Occasionally, fusions are done to stabilize an area that's been a problem area. They'll take bone chips and they'll simply get these guys to grow together so that you're more stable. Yes?
I just very recently had a friend whose vertebrae, one, dissolved.
The whole vertebra dissolved?
Whole vertebra.
Not the disc, but the vertebra.
No, and so the disc went, touched the nerve, mm-hmm. and he was in severe pain.
Wow.
So they took the disc out.
Uh-huh.
And what was left of the vertebrae.
Vertebra.
So that makes him a little bit shorter.
I'm sure it did. I'd say anywhere from half an inch.
It was in pain for a long
time. Oh, yeah. That's quite unusual. Yeah. The other thing I want to alert you to about those types of surgical approaches is, number one, it pays to get more than one opinion. Number two, the odds are not 100% cure at all. They're somewhere between 50 to 75%. The other option that's now being used more frequently once again is an enzyme injection. This was reinstated by the FDA this last fall, and the one that has been used so far in wide use is chymopapin, and that is basically a meat tenderizer enzyme, if you've done any reading on it. And it dissolves the mucoprotein that's in the pulp of your disc. Its success rate is just as high, if not better, than surgical procedures, somewhere around 75%. They are exploring other enzymes that, instead of dissolving the mucoprotein, dissolve the collagen fibers of the pulp. It does not seem to have the same allergic reaction potential that the meat tenderizer enzyme has. And so that's one that they're probably going to market soon. When we're talking about arthritis, we're talking about basically the use of heat. Most people find that very helpful. Anti-inflammatory medication. There's a variety of prescriptions available through physicians for that. Sometimes assistive devices or equipment. It may mean a cane, it may mean a walker later on. It may mean just handbars in the bathroom because you have trouble getting up and down. Those kinds of things. I'm going to move along a little more quickly. Scoliosis. Here, I think if it's caught early, the use of exercises is very appropriate to try to keep the muscles on the opposing side of the curve strong. Strengthen, keep both sides strong so that curve doesn't have a chance to get so exaggerated. When it does get beyond control and it's starting to affect the person systemically, you've got to do something else, and many times bracing is done, or even a surgical procedure where they use metal rods that are inserted to keep the spine straight. We're talking about fractures. We're usually talking about bed rest, a brace or a cast, body cast occasionally. And that's a long haul. You're talking about 3-4 months recovery many times. Posture, I think the best thing for that is awareness and exercise. And in terms of body build differences, for that long thin back or that overly long back, good education and prevention and strengthening exercises. And for that overweight person, the best thing I know is pushing your chair away from the table early. Okay, let's move into some prevention. Some of the things I'm going to mention in prevention will also overlap into self-helps when you get into trouble. There'll be some overlap there. First thing I want to do is to talk to you about body mechanics and its connection with posture. When we are using our body for work or play, doesn't matter, even sleeping, sitting, and standing, We need to be aware of how our body alignment is, how we line up our body. When you go to lift something up off a low surface, I don't care if it's the floor or where it is, it can be a Kleenex. I've had a muscle spasm with Kleenex. It doesn't have to be a child or a carton of whatever. Okay, you need to remember to use your knees and not your back. Okay, catch the difference. Use your knees, keep your back straight. And if you have to, walk back up those legs to get back up or use a piece of furniture. But it's very important, especially coming up, that you do not use your back, but you use your legs. When you're reaching for an object, remember to turn and face it. I don't know how many times, you know, we do this kind of stuff. And sometimes it doesn't come, and we give a little tug, you know. So face what you're going to get, whether it's a Kleenex box or your heavy suitcase. Use your legs. Keep the weight close to your body. Don't carry it out here if you can at all help it. And I think the other thing is to watch lifting over your head, anything that's real heavy. What we sometimes do when we do that over our head is we let our back go. All right, keep your hips tucked under and keep your weight over your spine so your back's straighter. You'll tolerate a lot better. That was something that was incredible to watch people in Africa carry immensely heavy loads on their head, but they were very straight. Okay, when we talk about standing and walking, the old thing your mother, I don't know if your mother did it, mine did, reminded me to stand tall. She'd come by, you know, give my hair a little tug. And when you think about it, if you square your shoulders and you bring your chin in, you have automatically straightened your back. If you let your chin go, you start to slump. Bring your chin in, square your shoulders. You don't have to raise your shoulders. You don't want to do that. Want your shoulders relaxed, but you want them squared back and your chin in. And the other thing is this guy down here, your abdomen. You want him in too, because if he's out, then you've let the lower back go out too. When you're sitting, to sit tall in your chair, I've seen a variety of sitting postures in the village. I've been fascinated as I sit through the lectures and watch people squirrel around on these captain's chairs.
Could I ask one question?
Yeah.
On the abdomen, are you meaning to flex your muscle?
Tighten it. Pull it in. No. Make your own corset out of your own muscles. You bet. A lot of us like to slouch in these chairs. I don't know about you, but my tailbone gets awful sore if I do it for more than just a couple minutes. So try to sit back into your chair. If you're getting uncomfortable, if you have something to put your feet up on, that's fine. But I find if I put them up with my knees straight, that after a while the back of my legs are starting to really bite. If you could put your feet up on something so that your knees are higher than your hips, you have flattened your lower back. If your knees are lower, did you see what my back did? It's curved, whereas if I bring my knees up, I can flatten this and keep that nice and relaxed and stretched. Okay, sleeping. That's why I brought the pillow. Okay, I had to demonstrate with something. Yeah, those of you in the back may have to stand for just a second. Couple rules about sleeping. If you are a person with back problems, most authorities will say do not sleep on your stomach. My dad has been disabled since he was 59 with a variety of back problems. He likes to sleep on his stomach. I said, Dad, how do you do that? He says, well, very simple. I put a pillow under my hips. If you're going to sleep on your back, you've got to do that.
Stomach.
Okay? Because then you have supported that low back area and it's not going to go down way into your bed. Most people prefer lying on their side, and when you do that, you put your knees together, or if you like to go with your knee forward, you are drawing on the low part of your back all night. It would be to your advantage to support that knee so these muscles back here can relax. Or put it between your knees. Now, you need to know a little funny, and that's my husband and I, since we both have back troubles, we both sleep with a pillow between our knees, and there's more pillows than there are bodies in our knees. We didn't get smart until about 3 years ago and buy a king-size bed. We went for umpteen years in a double bed. Now, if you're going to sleep on your back, you need to put it underneath your knees. Again, the reason being, if you sleep with your legs out straight, I've got a nice sway back, you should be able to see what my back's doing. I can put two hands underneath. Okay, if I bring my knees up a little bit, my back goes down and has a chance to relax. Make sense?
You can tighten your gluteus. You can tighten your gluteus maximus too, can't you?
To get your back down?
Yeah.
You're going to stay asleep while you got your gluteus maximus.
Oh, that was in an exercise though.
No, that's true. You can't. And I'll show that exercise and use it.
But you'll help with using a pillow or not using a pillow.
Under your head?
Under your
head. I think one that's not too thick is fine. The question was, do you put a pillow underneath your head? And I think one that's not real thick is fine. There are cervical pillows. They're like wieners, or hot dogs, I guess that's the best description. And that gives your neck support but allows the back of your head to go back a little bit. What I see in nursing homes, because I work in those too, is a lot of people who are on at least two pillows. And boy, after a while, there's no way they could even put their head back. Their spine, because of arthritis and everything else, and because of the postural position they've taken in bed, they've become fixed.
How about sleeping on a water bed?
In terms of your back, that's a real individual thing I've discovered. For some people, they swear by it. They say, boy, my back has, I haven't had troubles ever since I got a water bed. I'd say, great, we tried it, didn't work. I think sometimes it depends on how full the bed is filled and how many baffles you have in the bed. By baffles, I mean, you know, that inner system that's underneath it that slows down the swish. You get a lot less roll swish reaction because then it gives you a little more firm support. We looked at them a couple years ago when we decided to get a new bed, and we opted for a high-density foam instead because it gave us more firmness. Yeah, John?
It's fairly common for people to sleep in all three of the positions that you showed.
Yes.
I'm just wondering about how to put the pillow.
Yeah, and then you say, how do you keep the pillow with you?
Doing the right thing at the right time.
If you're conscientious about it, I think you do sort of wake up as you turn and you stick it in and then you go right back to sleep. At least that's what I do. Or else if I've turned and I have not taken the pillow with me, I may wake up a couple hours later and I'm hurting. Put the pillow back in. Next time I wake up, I'm fine. Or at the end of my sleep period, in the morning I wake up and I've already got some stiffness and soreness, I just stretch in bed. And I'll show you how to do that in a second to get rid of that soreness. Okay, the other thing is, in terms of body mechanics, it is always smarter to push rather than to pull. You're mechanically at an advantage, more solid if you push instead of pull. And if you have to sneeze or cough, try not to do it erect, or your back just gets throttled. Okay, try to get down, get your knees bent, and your hands on your thighs, around your back. Okay, now people who are in acute pain learn that very quickly. It's a matter of survival.
What is that again?
If you're going to sneeze or cough, all right, you will put, if you round your back, you put it in a protective position. Instead of standing up and it just is like a piece of, you know, grass in the wind that's getting shook. Okay, exercises, two don'ts, and I'm going to give you a lot of do's. The chief don't is, please don't ever do double leg raises. Now, describe what those are. I'm not going to demonstrate them because I want to hike this weekend. So when you're lying on your back and you raise both feet off the floor, it's that old, you know, high school army one they all love to do. Hold them 18 inches off the floor together for I don't know how long, we don't know. Okay? They're forever. There are very few people that I know of that can do it with their back flat on the ground. Maybe good gymnasts can, but I can't. And when you've got your back arched like that and those two legs up there, yeah, it's a great abdominal strengthener. It's one of the, you can hardly beat it, but it's really playing havoc with your back. So please don't ever do that one.
My husband lifts his head so that his back would be strengthened, wouldn't it? When he lifts his feet, his head is up.
Yeah, that'll help.
Another way you can do that is if you put your hands right here.
Yeah, yeah.
And that'll bring your back closer to the floor. It won't bring it all the way, but it'll bring it closer to the floor.
It's still arcing under stress in that position. I would much prefer to do sit-ups for abdominals than I would double leg raises.
This is quite subjective, isn't it? Because you know, I see where I was advised kind of the opposite of that. Is it up for grabs by different people?
There's a little bit of that. There's a little bit of there's a lot of individuality in terms of your own body and the problems that you've had over the years. I'm trying to talk to you as a group where I don't know anything about your history, and I will give you things that I know are safe. There are, and I'm going to show you in just a sec, some extension exercises, just the opposite of what I'm talking about, that are used for back strengthening and flexibility to get more flexibility in your back. And you bet, you lie on your stomach and you bring your legs up and you bring your arms up and you work on arching your back. Okay? But I have found that unless I know that person well and I know what's going on, I am risking a great deal to say it to an audience, because more times than not, it's the back flattening exercises that is, as a total population, we can all tolerate those. But it's a small minority who can tolerate and need the extension exercises. Thanks for bringing that up. When you do toe touches, if you do them for flexibility, that you let your knees go just a tad, about an inch, when you reach over. You don't have to have them locked. I don't want you to have them locked in hyperextension where they're just locked way back. Let them go just a tad. You're still going to get a good stretch. All right, and then when you come back up, drop your seat down and come up through your legs. Going down stretches your back. Coming up stresses your back. Okay? So bend your knees, tuck your seat under as you come up. The stretch, the reason you do the exercise, is in the first half, not the second half. Okay, do's. My favorite one, and again, I apologize for it, you may want to stand one more time, okay, is something called a pelvic tilt or a pelvic rock. And when you get up and down from the floor, if you're having troubles, it helps not to flop back or come straight up, but to turn on your side and roll on your back. See, I can hear a voice of experience. Okay. Now, what you're doing with a pelvic tilt is you are flattening this curve, that lumbar curve, to the floor, and you're pulling in your tummy muscles and you're rolling your hips forward, and you're holding it for about 5 seconds. You can still breathe. And then you relax. Once again. Okay, you're rolling your hips forward and pressing your back against the floor. You're doing it with your hips. If we were a smaller group, I'd have you all do it individually, but I think we're not. Okay, now you're not pushing with your feet or your shoulders to make it happen. It's just your pelvis. Tip the fruit basket. Roll it forward. Okay, sometimes when I have people who just can't find that part of their body, that can't make it work, I tell them, well, you've got an extension on your tailbone, and it's coming up through your legs, and you're going to pull that tail toward your nose. Sometimes that helps. Okay, the second one is something that everybody can do very easily. It's bringing your knee to your chest. Alternately, one and then the other. When you do both of them, I like to have one up already. Then you bring the second one up. That's where you really get a nice stretch. That's what I do in bed when I wake up sore and achy, or when I pull too many beans outside, I lay down on the lawn, or go inside. Do it in the living room, and then I put them down one at a time. Now, those two you can do when you're having trouble. In fact, when I get a muscle strain, those two exercises are the first thing I do, and I usually can work out most of that tension that's creeping in.
Do you hold them both for 5 seconds?
Yeah, that's about a good count. Then, if you're in pretty good shape, you can do a pelvic tilt and raise your hips up off the floor to make a bridge. When you come back down, you come down bump by bump, and your seat doesn't hit first, but your back hits, and then you roll out of it. So you're tilting, lifting, coming back down, vertebra by vertebra, and then you let your seat relax. Okay? Fourth one is a curl up, not a sit up. And you're bringing your head and shoulders forward, and you're working on these guys right here, your abdominals. Because your abdominals are what are giving your back support. And they need to be nice and strong. If you're really good, and I'm a little out of shape, you can go ahead and do a sit-up. But again, if you're doing, you know, this kind of thing, or if you're doing this kind of thing where you're arching to lift, that's wrong. You want to work through the curl up, then keep coming. That's right where it's tough, right there. Okay, from here on up, your legs take over. It's the first half of the sit-up that's important. And most people, irregardless of age, can get this far. That's the most important part. Okay, now those four.
Just raising your shoulders off the ground would be.
Just looking at your knees, just raising your head and looking at your knees makes your abdominals contract, and that's what I tell moms postpartum to do first day one after they've had their baby. Okay, now those four are often called Williams flexion exercises. They've been around for years, and they're a good, safe place to start.
Can you do that when you have a back pain?
Yeah, now I differentiated that. Let me do it again. When you have pain, you can do the first two. The pelvic tilt, the knee to chest, but not the second two. You do the bridges and the curl up once your pain is better. Gone, is what I meant to say. Okay.
What about sitting cross-legged in the chair?
Supposed to cross your leg.
Everybody does that.
Never cross your leg.
Never cross your leg. I don't cross my legs because it's bad on my circulation. You know,
yeah.
I think it depends on what your comfort level is with that. Some people can't sit without doing that. I don't have a big hang up back-wise. It does. If you've got a favorite leg, you're constantly torquing one direction. I'd like to change the other side now. But I think it's nice to vary your sitting posture. You shouldn't be sitting for too long anyway at a time, or at least in the same position.
First two words you used were oxygen and poison.
Mm-hmm.
What were you thinking of?
Well, in terms of your blood takes oxygen and nutrients to your muscle tissue.
Okay.
All right? Now, if your muscle is spasmed or tightened and tense, it constricts, tightens down on those blood vessels, so you do not get good blood flow to the muscle tissue. The waste products, some people call it poison, in the muscle do not have a chance to get out nor does the oxygen and nutrients have a chance to get in. Your muscle tissue fatigues, and it will hurt just from that alone. Okay? If you're going to insist on doing leg lifts, I'm having trouble with leg lifts, except double leg ones. If you've got a back weakness, then I prefer you put one knee bent and do your leg lift with one knee up supporting your back, okay? Now, I've had my calisthenics for tonight, getting up and down. I should have stayed down. All right, now, in addition to the exercises I've shown you, there's some nice stretching exercises you can do when you are pain-free and virtually problem-free, in the sense that you're not working with any acute pain at the time, and you want to work on keeping your back supple. The first one is sitting to walk down your legs and reach toward your toes. Now, the point is, don't insist on getting to your toes. Give yourself a nice, steady stretch. This will stretch pretty much all of your lower back and up into your mid-back, and also your hamstrings along the back of your leg. You can vary that by bringing one knee bent, so your foot is along your other leg, and walking down to straighten the leg. Then you can also do, if you're in really good shape, okay? This is said with a word of caution. And you want to work on most of your spine. You can do the one where you take your legs over your head that way. Or your knees down by your ears.
Okay. We were cautioned by that in an exercise class because it puts so much pressure.
I got a bruised cervical vertebra from that.
And they don't do it. They were doing it for several years and they quit even saying to do it.
You've got to have a good spongy mat or don't do it if you're going to do it at all. And I mean a gymnastic mat. I don't mean a carpet, because that's exactly what will happen. I have a real prominent vertebra there and you'll get it nice and sore. And aggravated. Okay, so that's a maybe. The other ones you can do standing up, I showed you one where you do a toe touch. The other one that you can do is to put your leg, this is for your hamstrings, your leg on a chair or the edge of the bed and reach down and you feel a nice stretch along your hamstrings. The thing about these stretching exercises that I've just showed you is they need to be done slowly, gradually. Don't try to be Superman or Superwoman and get down to your toes the first time. It is helpful to work on the flexibility in your back, but you need to also work with strengthening it. Okay, there's some other things that have been happening nationally in terms of prevention, and it's in the form of what are called back schools. You can sit down now. I'm going to quit demonstrating. back schools are basically programs that are being offered both to communities at large and also to businesses and firms. They'll come in and give kind of an abbreviated anatomy lesson, and again, much the same thing I'm doing with you in terms of hints on body mechanics, care, prevention, so that to reduce that employee rise in back injury. So you may hear of those kinds of things happening. Now, we're going to switch completely into talking about care of when it happens to you. I've given you two hints already. The gentle stretching with the pelvic tilt and the knee to chest. And please stop with those two. By no means are you to do other kinds of exercises at that point when your back is sore. It may be so sore that you can't even do those two. Okay, then you start with rest and ice. Now, ice the first 24 hours is to help prevent swelling from occurring in the muscle tissue and complicating the problem even more. You can do it a couple ways. You can take towels and bring them out and sort of put them in the freezer for a little bit. That's kind of an iced towel. You can use ice packs, those are usually quite bumpy and hard and very uncomfortable to lie on. You can have somebody give you an ice massage. You can just take a styrofoam cup, fill it with water, stick it in the freezer, or keep one there. You peel off a ring of the styrofoam, lay down and have someone. I know it sounds terrible, but believe me, when you're hurting, it feels good. Have them just go up and down over that area. You don't stay in one spot. Hold it. Got it? You're moving. Now, how long do you do it? Well, 5 to 10 minutes. If the skin starts to get white after it's been pink, stop. That's frostbite. It will get pink. All right? That's normal. But you don't want it to get white after it's got pink. All right. Okay, that's the first thing. After that initial 24 hours, you can also use a cold water bag, by the way. You can now switch to heat, usually, after that first 24 hours. Some people like to stay on ice longer than that, and that's fine. But you can switch to moist heat. Most of us respond to that with smiles instead of goosebumps. How do you make moist heat at home? You can buy heating pads that have a sponge in them that you can moisten. You can also take your regular heating pad, take a hand towel, wring it out in hot water, and you put your heating pad down on the bed first. Put a plastic bag over it that has no holes. That's to protect you and the bag from any kind of electrical difficulties. And then you put the hot towel that's been wrung out on top of the plastic. You put your body on top of the towel. 20 to 30 minutes. Once you get the towel warmed up, your heating pad should be on low. We see too many people with burns. You know, they sleep with it all night. Or they are diabetic and they don't realize that their skin is thin and they do not have normal skin sensation. And they end up burning their back. Okay. Then, along with the rest and the moist heat, try to work into a few little gentle stretching exercises. No vacuuming, no dishes, no gardening. No dinner. If you can talk someone in your family into massaging your back, that usually can feel quite good, again, unless your spasms are really, really intense where you don't want to be touched. There are some relaxation techniques that are becoming more prominent that basically, once you know them, you can do on your own. They can be very helpful. Very quickly, since our time's getting close here, one of them is called progressive relaxation. It's by a physician who's been around since the late 20s. John shaking his head. It's an oldie but goodie. And what you're doing is basically exaggerating the tension in your body and then letting it go. And your muscle tension will tend to let go more fully after you have intensified it. It's kind of an isometric way of working with it. You could do just part. You could work with your whole body. I do it in prenatal classes, and I start them at their feet and tense them all the way up to their eyebrows, and then I let them let it go, and then we go back through mentally and check it all out. Do I have all those areas relaxed? And I have their partner check them pre and post after they've done it, and they usually have loosened up quite a bit. Another one's called differential relaxation. You may think I'm splitting hairs, but the people who came up with these insist that they're different. And differential relaxation is focusing, again, mentally on muscles that are tight and relaxing them mentally by will with deep breathing. And you can do it. When you're lying in bed tonight, before you go to sleep, check out inside. Have you really relaxed your shoulders? What about that hand? Did you really let go? Your neck. Okay, you can learn to tune in and find the tense spots in your body. Another one is called autosuggestion, where it's quite similar to biofeedback in the sense that you are saying to yourself, my hands are getting warm. My heart is slowing down. And you repeat that for about 10 minutes and those physiological changes will actually occur. You can raise the skin temperature in your in your hands, and you can slow your heart down. But it takes some training and some practice. Okay, another one's called modified meditation. If any of you do meditation, the only thing that you change, instead of using a mantra or a word that you concentrate on, you use a specific word. Guess what it is?
Relax.
Got it. Okay. And again, this is very similar to what's presented in the book Relaxation Response. Now, if that's something that you're interested in, I would strongly encourage you to take a look at that book, because it's been very helpful to a lot of, I know, my patients, to my husband, and to a lot of other people. Okay, the last one is probably the most fascinating one. I've never tried it. It's called self-imaging, where you actually visualize yourself erect without pain instead of crunched over, hurting. Or you may visualize yourself in a nice warm chair by the fireplace, kind of melting. Okay, one little last comment on chronic pain, the long haul. I think when we start to talk about chronic pain or the chronic back sufferer, we start to get into the area where Ed Schneider so did such a beautiful job the other day on holistic health care. When you're talking about long-term pain, you have to realize that you're not just treating physical symptoms, you're treating that whole person, their self-esteem, their sense about what they can do physically, what they're worth in life, and it's very important not to just keep renewing the prescription. Okay, I'd like to share a quote in that regard. It's from a Dr. Vert Mooney, who happens to be the chief of the orthopedic surgery department at the University of Texas Health Center in Dallas. It reads this way. Pain is not a separate entity in our lives, he points out. It is connected with our whole lifestyle, our rewards, our vocations, our family relationships, our feelings of worth. Chronic pain is likely to have an emotional involvement. It can be used for many things. It's a way to explain why you haven't done well in the world. It can be used to punish a spouse or as an excuse not to work. That sounds a little harsh, but I've seen it happen. There are some pain centers that are developing around the country that try to help people with chronic long-term pain that I think are worth remembering. I don't know where they all are. We have one in Omaha in our state of Nebraska. There's also one in Dallas called the Spinal Pain Program.
And UCLA
has one.
University of
They're really cropping up just many, many major cities, and I think can really give some good input. Okay, before the bell goes off, we got a few questions, I think.
About driving very long.
Thank you. It's important to stop at least every hour or so. Get out and walk around. I don't care if you need a rest area for the facilities or not. Stop and get out and walk around. It's very important. Helmer?
Same thing I was told. There are two knees above the
right.
Hips.
If it means, putting a block, stool that you built with your feet in the car, that really helps. Over here?
I noticed you've been eliminating all twisting exercises, and I was wondering why.
It's intentional. If I have a patient that I know can handle flexibility exercises, you bet I'll give them all kinds of stuff, that work on twisting the spine to keep that flexibility. But when I'm working with someone that's arthritic or has disc symptoms, I will not do any type of twisting with them. And it's for a reason. It's not safe.
I said that if I don't do some kind of back twisting exercise, I do have back trouble.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I was wondering why you're on
that. Yeah. And I, Bill and I both do them when we are symptom free to stay flexible, and because that's the first thing that you lose is rotation as you grow older.
And of course, swimming, you do a lot of twisting.
You bet. Swimming's probably one of the best exercises you could ever do for your back.
You answered that.
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah,
don't recommend aspirin or anything anymore, exercise, right?
I stayed away from medications intentionally. Aspirin is an anti-inflammatory medication along with being a pain reliever. And so many times doctors will prescribe aspirin, especially when there is arthritic symptoms. And they'll prescribe it 8 tablets a day, 2 every 4 hours, to work at getting some anti-inflammatory effect in your bloodstream. If you're taking less than that, you're not really doing the job. You're getting some pain relief, but not any anti-inflammatory component. The reason I didn't want to get into medications per se is that somebody who's taking aspirin in that quantity needs to be under physician's care, because aspirin is also a blood thinner. And so when you're taking that much, I would feel more comfortable with it coming from the doctor if you're going to do it for an extended time. The other thing is, he knows what your stomach's like. Can your lining tolerate aspirin, or do you need to go to something else?
Do x-rays show a lot of these things that you have up there?
Well, x-rays will certainly show you if you have scoliosis. It's black and white. They don't always show a ruptured disc, and what the test is that's definitive for that is a myelogram, and unfortunately they won't do it unless they suspect you're going to need surgery, because it's risky. They inject dye in the spinal fluid, then they take a film, and they see that nice little bulge out there on the film. But there are risks with doing a myelogram. So they'll take an x-ray first and try and do everything else but surgery. That's a last resort. Thank you for being such an example.